The John Age Project.
Trust no one. Trust no one. Trust no one.
I'm your host, John Age. We got a great show for you today. Before we get into that, please check out AnomicAge.com. Share that link with your friends, family, loved ones, and enemies. From there, you can check out all the old shows, all the most recent shows, the video, the audio, the guest links, that nice new segment of the page called the Information Breakdown segment. Tons of those. Just about every other day, we got some more pieces of the puzzle to put into place in that segment. Also, we have PayPal link, Patreon link, newsletter. If you want to go direct, paypal.me/AnomicAge and patreon.com/AnomicAge too. Don't forget that newsletter. We're going to need that as the months get closer and closer to November and beyond for sure. You can also email me, find out tons of other information right there at AnomicAge.com. So, without further ado, let's take it over to our guest, and we will see you in just a mere matter of moments with our guest on the other side. Stick around. It's my pleasure to welcome Douglas V. Gibbs into the Anomic Age today. Douglas is a radio host, Fox News contributor, author, publisher, president of the Constitution Association, public speaker, and an instructor of the United States Constitution. Doug is a member of the California Republican Assembly, Unite Inland Empire, Patriot Group Coalition, the American Authors Association, the Military Writers Society of America, and a board member of Birth Choice
Temecula.
Tempecula, thank you. Tempecula Pregnancy Center. He received the Golden Anchor Award for his patriotic commentary in 2008 and received a California State Senate Certificate of Recognition in 2014. Doug is a family man, married 31 years to his high school sweetheart. He is a father of two and has six grandchildren. Doug is also a proud United States Navy veteran. Doug, it's
Bios. You have one of my older bios, so let me make two corrections. Number one, we've been married now 36 years.
Oh, 36. Good grief.
And we have seven grandchildren now.
All right.
Yeah, so there you go.
Thank you, Doug, for being on the show. You're so busy, man. I wish you'd get to work. Good grief.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm blessed. I am blessed that I can do this full-time and have a wife that's willing to work overtime to keep the lights on.
Indeed. It's so good to talk to you. I know we've been talking for a while off the air. I guess we should just delve into the Constitution first and foremost, because that's definitely your wheelhouse. And it seems to be a whole lot of egregious oversteps of that that old Constitution going on right about now.
Well, and as a host, I'm sure the questions about the Constitution that are in your mind are probably the same ones that are in your listeners' minds. So I don't know if you want me to just start talking about the Constitution or if you've got specific questions. Either way, we can go.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of the stuff I've been thinking about recently is just I think it was last week on MSNBC, Nancy Pelosi was using all this what I would sort of term as patriotic jargon. She was saying enemies of the state and enemies foreign and domestic, and not by herself. It was Eric Holder. It's been Joe Biden. It's been old Mad Max, Maxine Waters as well. All of them are throwing out this jargon as if they're on the constitutional side of things. And they're always referring to our president, President Trump, and basically saying, we're not going to take anything but a win. No matter what the election says, we're going to occupy, we're going to withdraw from the union and all this talk. what's the constitutional basis in this? Because I'm definitely no expert as you are, but it doesn't sound very sound to me.
Well, you know, what's funny about all that jargon is that, and you know, it's hard for me to say this because I wasn't necessarily a Donald Trump fan in the beginning. My wife was, but in the beginning, I really wasn't sure. But as I've watched his presidency, and I've had people's jaws hit the concrete when I say this, Donald J. Trump is the most constitutional president we've had since Calvin Coolidge. Mm-hmm. That means he's even more constitutional than Ronald Reagan was. He has followed the Constitution to a T. And that's what's driving them nuts. Because, see, while they wrap themselves in the American flag in the Constitution for perception, they're really the opposite. And the fact that he's following the original intent is driving them nuts. Because, to be honest with you, this isn't the Constitution to them. This is an obstacle. The Constitution to them is the cases by judges that they can find that agree with them. That's the Constitution. And he's violating those leftist ideals. Now, when it comes to enemies of the state and all of that, really, if anybody is, it would be them, because in Article 1, Section 8 and Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, it warns against domestic violence and insurrection. In the 14th Amendment in Section 3, it indicates that anybody who holds office who gives aid and comfort or support to insurrectionists shall lose their office and not be able to regain holding office unless Congress, by two-thirds vote, removes that disability. So by them supporting the insurrectionists on the streets of Portland, on the streets of Seattle, and giving them aid and comfort, really, if anybody is the enemies of the state, it's them.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way to me. I mean, it's kind of funny. My wife and I were talking after President Trump's speech from D.C. a few nights ago, and she had the same sort of constitutional questions. She's like, well, what can he do? And then he addressed that in the speech. He's like, you know, I'm waiting for these mayors or these governors to sort of give me the nod and ask for assistance. So he can't technically just go in there, carte blanche, and send in Fort Bragg
and
special forces or anything.
That's a yes and a no. Let's go back to Katrina to give an example. One of the criticisms of George Bush when Katrina hit was that FEMA didn't come in fast enough to give aid. George Bush was following the Constitution. FEMA could not come in until the governor asked for the assistance because local issues belongs to the states, state sovereignty. So a federal government normally cannot interfere without an invitation from the state. And Governor Blanco of Louisiana was refusing to declare a state of emergency. And what goes along with declaring a state of emergency is a request for federal assistance. So by refusing to declare a state of emergency, she was refusing to accept federal assistance. So he was criticized, actually, President Bush, holding back FEMA for doing exactly what the Constitution demands and what the governor of Louisiana was demanding. Now, there are exceptions. Mm-hmm. Insurrection is one of them. In the case of insurrection, and I mentioned Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, I can read it in a moment, it gives the federal government the authority, regardless of what the states say, to go in there and take care of business. So if for those of you who have a Constitution, follow along with me. Article 4, Section 4 says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government. So now that says the states are not allowed to become an Islamic republic. They're not allowed to become a pure democracy. They're not allowed to become a socialist system. They are required to remain a republican form of government, and it's up to the federal government to guarantee that. Then it says, and shall protect each of them against invasion and on application of the legislature or of the executive when the legislature cannot be convened against domestic violence. Now, what that is saying there is that if the legislature of the state says we need help, then the federal government can come in against domestic violence. When the legislature cannot be convened, then of the executive, which is the governor. Then we go to Article 1, Section 8. In Article 1, Section 8, it says that Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of union, suppress insurrections, repel invasions. So here's the difference between the two. Article 4, Section 4 allows the federal government to use federal agencies if the state says it's okay, or the mayors or whatever, they say, okay, we need your help. That's what he's abiding by. However, state militias, which 24 of the states still have state militias, you know, those same militias that fought the American Revolution.
Exactly.
You read about the war between the states, and you had such and such infantry of Pennsylvania state militias. 24 states still have state militias. The federal Congress can call those militias into action, and the president, if according to Article 2, then becomes the commander-in-chief over those militias to repel insurrections, regardless of whether or not the state wants the help, because they're using state people. So in order to repel insurrection or to quell domestic violence, the federal government can do it without waiting for the state saying, all right, come on in and help us, if they do it through the state militia. Otherwise, federal government has to wait until the legislature, and if the legislature can't convene, then the governor asks for the help. So, yeah, it goes back to the FEMA thing. So George Bush, you know, held back, and he was supposed to. He got criticized for it. Right now, Trump is holding back, and he's right. He needs to really wait until they give him the okay, unless he has a dial-in with the local militias. Now, that all said, I think he's holding back anyway for other reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Because as he holds back, the left are revealing who they really are. As you watch this, I guarantee, while the radicals are not saying this to themselves, there are a lot of lifelong Democrat voters who were the low-hanging fruit, may not necessarily buy into all the socialist stuff, but they have bought into the touchy-feely propaganda. And they're watching this and they're saying, oh, man, my Democrat Party has left me.
Yeah.
I mean, can't vote for them anymore.
A little bit before we started talking, and I think that might be kind of a key to it. I don't think he wants the optics of tyrannical dictator and sending in the –
Oh, exactly. Well, see, they want him to send people in because they want their version of Kent State, if you know what Kent State was.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they want. So what the left does is they're sort of like the bully in the schoolyard. They poke you in the chest, and they poke you in the chest, and they poke you in the chest until finally you take a swing.
Mm-hmm.
Then they beat the garbage out. You say, well, he started it. He took the first swing. That's what they're doing. And so the restraint by this president while getting poked in the chest is amazing, first of all. Second of all, they're revealing exactly who they are. While we are quick to judge the voting public as not being real bright, there are many members of the voting public that are quite bright. They're not so stupid that they don't see what's going on. I think if the fraud is not out of control like some people think it will be, if they're not able to steal the election, Trump will not only win, he'll win by such a landslide that it'll be historical. Because people that are on the Democrat side are either not going to vote for Democrat or they're going to vote for Trump. But even if they don't vote for Democrat and they don't vote for him, that's still a vote taken away from the Democrats. And I think the Democrats have really cut their own throat on this. I really do. And the thing is, they're so invested in it, there's no turning back.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that revealing. I've just said they've been uncloaking now for about a year. I mean, you kind of, I guess, expect it from perhaps some of the newer kids on the block, like the AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. That's the obvious. But you're also getting it from the older elk, if you will. Like Mad Max, exactly. And
well, they kind of have to because they think. Got to remember, these people live in a bubble.
Oh yeah.
So first of all, I remember Pelosi saying this, and I remember another Democrat back in the 70s said something similar. I remember Pelosi back in 2008 says I can't remember if it was an open mic situation or an interview, but she says, I don't understand how John McCain got as many votes as he did, because I don't know anybody who voted for John McCain. Well, they live in their bubble. They think the world is what they see. They don't realize what's on the outside. So from their point of view, America has turned the left corner. We're ready for socialism. They've got the majority. They just have to. So the election of Trump was weird to them. How did that happen? Because our bubble says we've got control of the country now. We've turned the corner. We don't understand. He must be an anomaly. Don't worry, when he's done, then we'll do. And now they're doing their internal polling, and they're realizing, wait a second, this guy could win again. How is that possible? I don't know anybody who would vote for him. So, you know, got to remember, they're in this little world, and they don't see what's on the outside. And so they really don't live in reality. First of all, second of all, the ends justify the means anyway. All they know is they think that the light at the end of the tunnel for their ends is within sight. And this guy who's outside the system that they can't control is in the way. So they'll just have to push harder. They push harder. They push harder. And once you start pushing that hard, eventually you get to the point where you pass the point of no return. Mm-hmm. So now they have to side with the radicals because they've gone past the point of no return. They're trying to convince everybody through perception, though, that they're not really that radical. They're not siding with the radicals. That's why they have Biden as their candidate, because he's that nice guy, you know, that nice little moderate. See, he's like a grandpa. He could do no harm.
Yeah.
And, you know, he said in a speech the other day, what, do I look like a socialist? You know, and I'm like, no, you look like the perverted grandpa that everybody's trying to hide their kids from, but nonetheless.
That's what I was about to say. You look like a total creepy pervert guy, but that's
Creepy Joe. But they think the voters are so dumb. Oh, it's just Joe, okay. That they don't see, you know, what's going on behind the curtain, that the wizard is actually a big giant socialist radical movement. But like I said, I think if they don't steal the election, and I think the president saw the voter fraud coming 2 years ago, I think that there's mechanisms in place to stop it, or at least mitigate it. One thing I've learned about this president is while they play checkers, he's playing three-dimensional chess.
Yeah.
And so I think he saw this coming, and I have been telling people I wouldn't be surprised if he picked up 45 states. I've actually had people say that they think he'll get all 50. Well, I'll be shocked if he can get Hawaii, California, Washington, Vermont, which is Bernie country, Massachusetts. If he can pick up those states, I'd be surprised. But here's the reality of it. And this is what people don't really realize. He doesn't have to win in a landslide. He doesn't have to be unbelievably popular. If the Democrats pick up what the states they normally pick up, the Republicans pick up the states they normally pick up, and then Trump gets, again, Ohio, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Florida, as long as he gets those four states and everything else is just goes where they normally go, he wins. Any other state, that's icing on the cake. Michigan, which surprised me last time. That was the one state I did not predict. It was Michigan.
Yeah, that was kind of a shocker.
You know, that's icing on the cake. But now we're hearing that even states like New York could be in the conversation. States like Minnesota and Wisconsin might be in the conversation of voting for Trump. And if that happens, well, I'm not sure what the left's going to do, but I have a feeling he has anticipated it. But once again, we've got a president who's able to anticipate. He just thinks on levels that amaze me. And I want to say this before you go on to your next question. I remember when he first got elected, and a friend of mine who is still to this day a never Trumper, by the way, never Trumping conservative. And he says, Doug, don't you realize he's not even a Republican? And I said, well, dude, don't you realize? That's the point.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good thing.
he's outside the voting party. He's outside the party Republicans. System. Yeah, exactly. He's outside the party system. He's outside the establishment. He's outside the swamp. He's just a businessman who's going, hey, I see a problem. I like fixing things. I see it as a challenge. We need to do it for our country's sake anyway. Let's do it. And it just turns out that the right way to do it turns out to be the constitutional way. I don't think the guy knows this document nearly as well as some people might think he does. But he knows the right way to do things, and it so happens to coincide with the Constitution. And I'm sure he's got some people around him giving him some constitutional advice anyway. But, yeah, no, he's been the most – get back to the original statement. He's been the most constitutional president since Calvin Coolidge. And it's even shocking for me to be able to say that, because in the beginning I was sort of like my never Trumper friend. I'm like, okay, you know, I don't know about this guy. You know, we need Scott Walker. That was my, you know, that was my candidate. And Scott Walker was gone quick. And then I was kind of, well, maybe Ben Carson. I couldn't support Ted Cruz because he was ineligible. Mm-hmm. I actually was on the radio quite a bit over that, and conservatives were very mad at me. But when Trump wound up getting the nod, I was like, okay, I'll vote for him because he's not Hillary. And then about 2 or 3 months into his presidency, one of my co-hosts, who's no longer with my show, Alex, says to me, and he was like me, he wasn't sure about Trump beginning, he says, Doug, and he says this on the air, he says, Doug, you know what? It turns out I didn't get the president I wanted, but America got the president it needed. Hmm. And I think that pretty much sums it up.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good call. I mean, one of the only things that I think really concerns me is this whole absentee ballot mess. I don't know about you, but there's like a huge billboard here, and I got a text the other day and emails about it. You can get your absentee ballot right now. Have you looked into getting your absentee ballot? And I'm going, man, I imagine like the swaths masses are getting these emails, and a lot of them, for better or worse,
President Trump saw that coming. I think President Trump saw that coming. I think President Trump saw that coming. And you can look this up. I don't know a lot about it yet. I'm just learning about it. I learned about this last Wednesday. Is he's got put in place something called the blockchain, which will mitigate the damage of mail-in ballots. So, I mean, like I said, three-dimensional chess.
I certainly hope so. I mean, back to what's going on in these cities. I was asking somebody else who – hopefully we'll be on tomorrow, but he was close to the shooting that went down this past weekend. And it's hard for a lot of America to really grasp the severity of this stuff. I mean, I know you're in California. You're definitely not up in Portland or CHOP or CHAZ or whatever they've turned it into, but it's so vastly different on West Coast versus East Coast. And I can only imagine in that middle America as well.
Well, folks in smaller towns and all that don't understand. I am midway between Los Angeles and San Diego in Southern California. And believe it or not, we have been seeing the violence and the madness. I have a friend of mine who works for a aerospace machine shop. And once the parts are machined, he's supposed to deliver them to the different customers in LA County. He hasn't been able to work because one of the biggest problems in LA County right now is if you are a white person by yourself in a vehicle, you will be forced off the road by a gang of black folks in a vehicle, forced off the road, pulled out of your car, and then beaten the crap out of them and left on the side of the road. And that has happened dozens and dozens and dozens of times in LA County. In San Diego County, the Black Lives Matter, they've left the deep part of the city. They're now going to suburban neighborhoods and attacking and marching and waking people up in the middle of the night. In Temecula, they've been targeting homes owned by police officers. Also in Temecula, and the thing about Temecula and Murrieta and Menifee, there's three cities kind of out here in between L.A. and San Diego, is we're like this little conservative enclave. So, yes, those exist in Southern California. Real conservative towns, we're called the new Orange County, because Orange County in California used to be real, you know, Republican, real conservative, and it's been flipped blue. And what happened is the conservatives in Orange County moved out here where I'm at, and now we are the conservative hub of Southern California. And because we're conservative, we're targeted. So we actually have now two recently appointed city council members in Temecula that are associated with Black Lives Matter, who have now pushed a resolution on this very conservative city to defund their police, accusing the police of being racist and all sorts of stuff. Now, this is a town. This is a town that is really considered small town California. We only have about 100,000 people in our town, and that's a small town because we're kind of out here by ourselves. But anyway, and they are targeting us. We have Black Lives Matter. Matter of fact, about four blocks from my house every day, Black Lives Matter, right on the at the intersection. And nobody pays attention to them, but I mean, they're all over the place. And we've had confrontations out here. There has been some violence. I have some property up on the Oregon coast, and I was up there in July, and they had a Black Lives Matter protest. It was five white women holding up BLM signs and everybody laughing at them. I mean, you know, because that's small town America. That was the difference. Here, I mean, we're talking hundreds of, you know, of young white kids and black kids holding up Black Lives Matter signs on certain stuff. Now, that said, because we're a relatively conservative area, we've had a lot of counter-protest rallies. The police are getting nervous because there's been some confrontations, but for the most part, they've been able to keep us apart. But this is a daily thing here. And on top of the fact that, you know, if you're not wearing a mask, you could actually – our sheriff, luckily, is a conservative guy, so he will not do that. But in California, if you are caught not wearing a mask in public, you're subject to a fine of $1,000. Now, I've not worn a mask. I wore one five times in March. I've not worn one since. Mm-hmm. I tell people I have a medical exemption. Which I do. I have vertigo, and if I wear a mask and I have less oxygen, my chances of going into vertigo increases. But I've actually had stores kick me out even though I have a medical exemption. That's how bad it is.
I know you mentioned this off air that somebody was trying to rough you up in a store for not wearing a mask.
Yeah,
I was
at a grocery store. I was at a grocery store getting ready to go in the entrance. And I walk with a cane, and a big guy elbows me, knocks me against the wall, knocks me ground. He says, "Wear an effing mask, you know, a-hole." You know, I've had a little old lady shaking their fingers at me inside the store because I don't have a mask on. You know, because people really bought into this. I'm a firm believer. If you look at the numbers, that it's not a thing. First of all, second of all, these cloth masks, that's like trying to stop a mosquito with a chain link fence.
Yeah, let's explain to somebody. If you can see through it with your own eye, you have to see a virus through a microscope. So,
right.
Well, that makes sense.
Well, the argument is that the masks are to stop the spreading, so that when you cough or you sneeze, you're not spreading it. Well, to see how what that is called is an aerosol effect. So, to see if your mask is efficient enough, all you need to do is go home, take an aerosol, spray it in your mask, and see if it sprays out the other side. That's all you need to do.
Yep.
Guess what? 99% of them, it's not doing anything. First of all. Second of all, if this virus was airborne, there's nothing you could do about it. It'd be like the video games with bodies laying in the streets.
Exactly.
When you really look at the numbers, I think they have the death toll in the United States at 168,000. But if you separate the people who died from COVID-19 only and didn't have a severe health issue in addition to, that number is 9,000. You know, you have if you're under 65, you have a 98% chance if you get the disease of it not being symptomatic. In other words, you're sick and you didn't even know it.
Yeah.
So it's ridiculous. But and what cracks me up is when I'm here in California and I'm driving on the road and there's people by themselves in their car with a mask on.
Oh yeah.
Or they're out jogging with a mask on.
I wish I had taken a picture of this the other day. There was a bus driver that had two masks on. I look over in traffic and I saw one and then I saw another. She's got two of these things on. And I'm going, man, you're really going to do some carbon poisoning there with you.
Well, it's not just that, but it's like I tell people, unless you're a plant and you're capable photosynthesis, you're probably going to need all the oxygen you need.
Exactly.
Carbon dioxide, your body expels it for a reason, but not only carbon dioxide, your body is also expelling other contaminants and toxins that your body is trying to get rid of. And some of those toxins and contaminants get caught in the mask, and then you breathe them back in. First of all. Second of all, science. Your immune system is like, you ever heard the term, use it or lose it? Your immune system is like that. If you're not using your immune system.
Building up these antibodies.
Yeah, if you're not using your immune system, it's like rest. It's like, oh, okay, well, I'm going to weaken because I'm not needed.
Mm-hmm.
First of all. Second of all, it's like I tell my listeners, let's say hypothetically this is a thing. Well, if it is a thing, this virus then will likely mutate and come back stronger. So wouldn't you want to get sick with it while it's in its weaker form now so that you have the antibodies for when it comes back stronger? But by running and hiding from it, now you're completely defenseless when it comes back stronger. That doesn't even consider in hospitals, they're reporting 4 times the normal rate of suicide. Depression, there's domestic violence, there's all kinds of other things going on as side stories. I mean, you know, which is worse, the disease or the cure?
Yeah, I mean, I'm convinced this is a massive psychological operation, like a cult mind control. I mean, I always kind of jokingly say it's like the Hokey Pokey. When this thing first started, you got to be 6 foot apart, then 10 feet apart, and you got to wear the mask. We can't wear the mask. And stay home, but
they're conditioning you to do what you're told.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
And sometimes, because I got a smart mouth, I had this one guy one time criticize me at a grocery store. I walked by him, and he mumbles under his breath, under his mask, not wearing a mask, I'm like, sorry, sir? He says, well, you're not wearing a mask. You should be wearing a mask like everybody else. I said, well, first of all, I have a medical exemption, but I want to thank you. I want to thank you for being an obedient comrade. And then I walked away. Now, whether or not it planted a seed, I don't know. But that's what it is. They're being obedient comrades for something that, I mean, it's like I said to one person, I bet you'll be first in line for the armbands when they start handing those out.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, you know, if you do the science, if you really common sense science, less oxygen's bad. You know, wearing these things all the time can't be good. Now, I mean, I get it. Every once in a while, you got to wear a mask. When I was construction on dusty, you know, the dust is in the air. We wore masks. I get it. But all the time can't be good for you. Just can't be.
Yeah, I mean, I was up in the attic for months, I feel like, doing all this work. And there was insulation. So I had the full respirator thing on because I wasn't trying to breathe in insulation particles. But, you know, it doesn't serve much purpose for the COVID.
Now let's drag the Constitution kicking and screaming into this conversation.
Let's do it, man.
First of all, there's no authority in the Constitution for the federal government to dictate to you what to wear or whatever. When it comes to state constitutions, if you read your state constitution, all of them have this language. It says that the legislative power is vested in the legislature of the state. And it may not use those exact words, but the word vested will be there. The word vested is important because what that is a granting of power, but because it's the word vested and not grant, it also means that's irrevocable. So it means that all legislative powers belong to the legislative arm of your state government. So if you have a government who's using executive orders to make these orders without legislative backing, they are not law. And they're not enforceable, and there cannot be tickets. And they should lose any lawsuits against them on that. It's one of the lawsuits I'm working on against Gavin Newsom. I mean, the guy's got millions of lawsuits. Unfortunately, we've got the Ninth Circuit out here, which is – we call it the Ninth Circus. But but it's actually gotten better because Trump has appointed some better judges in some of these districts and on the circuit. It's about even now. But first of all, your governor does not have the constitutional authority to make those orders, number one. Number two, all of the state constitutions I've looked at. I haven't looked at North Carolina's, but I'm going to guess it's similar. There is nothing in those constitutions that allows the state government to quarantine the healthy. However, there is a paragraph to three paragraphs, depending on the state constitution, about how important it is to quarantine the unhealthy, those who are infected. And some of them will also have language saying the infected and those who were around the infected who may have been exposed. But there's nothing in any of them that I've looked at allowing the federal government to quarantine the healthy. Next point. Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution tells states that they're not allowed to interfere with contracts. That includes any and all contracts. Employment contracts, service contracts, property contracts. And so by forcing businesses to act in a certain manner or by not allowing, forcing them to shut down or not allowing them to do, like here, you know, most businesses are not allowed to let anybody indoors.
Yeah. Same thing here.
Okay. They are violating Article 1, Section 10 because those businesses have contracts for doing business, and they're violating those contracts. So constitutionally, the state government's violating Article 1, Section 10 when it comes to the contract clause. And I mean, I could go on and on, but those are the top things. So when we talk about the masks and the shutdowns and the, you know, it used to be you couldn't go out to eat at all. Now they're allowing outdoor dining here. But dictating to a business how they can operate when their contract says that they have a building for indoor dining, that contract now has been violated. If a fence company has said, well, you're not allowed to do fences right now because of COVID-19, because you could do the spread. Well, my contract, my service contract says that I do that. You're violating my service contract. So the state governments are violating the contract clause right and left with this.
That's what I've been thinking all along.
So it's unconstitutional across the board.
It's from the beginning here. I was thinking, is this some sort of decree from King George where we get this communist Roy Cooper in North Carolina says, oh, well, this month, and then now we're into month two where you have to wear the mask. And it just seems so bizarre a world where it's dictating what businesses are essential and non-essential, which seems like, if nothing else, just a civil rights violation. Like, okay, so I'm not essential because I have a cleaning service, but right. Walmart is essential and the liquor store is essential.
But the church is not essential, but the casinos are.
Yeah, that was going to be my next point. And then you got the churches shut down. I mean, I can't even fathom my grandparents' generation.
I mean, they
got
to be jumping for joy being able to do that, right? Because mm-hmm. they hate Christianity. They hate faith. It's funny because I mentioned to you off air earlier that my wife and I have some property up on the Oregon coast.
Mm-hmm.
When we were up there in July, we saw a sign on a business. And this sign should be on every business in America. And it said this: the government wants us to require you to wear a mask to enter our business. However, because of HIPAA and the Fourth Amendment, if you have a medical exemption, we can't ask you why.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, if you're not wearing a mask, we're going to assume that you have a medical exemption. Come in and enjoy our establishment.
I love it.
Now, my wife and I celebrated our 36th wedding anniversary on August 18th, and we wanted to go out to eat. So we had to drive to Utah to go out to eat. five and a half hours. So we had dinner. We spent the night. We had lunch, and then we drove back. I mean, that's how, you know. Now, if you do that in New Mexico and they find out you drove in from out of state, you are required by the state to have a 2-week quarantine.
That's what I was saying. Quarantine you in a hotel room or something.
Yeah, exactly. New Mexico and Hawaii are the two states doing that. So, you know, the ridiculousness goes on. But and once again, it's against the Constitution. Now, that said, let me tell you one more story. In 1777, the colonies were hit with a smallpox epidemic. And remember, the Revolutionary War was going on at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
Did they did the people of that time period, the Thomas Jeffersons and the James Madisons of the era, did they shut down government or did they shut down the, I'm sorry, business? Did they shut down the economy? No. Now, they did have a vaccine. Well, sort of a vaccine. It was a weakened version of the smallpox. And if you injected in, you would still get sick with the disease, but it would be milder because it was a weakened version of the smallpox virus. And then you would be ill for about 2 weeks and you'd be over it. Then you'd have the antibodies and you're good. But it was not a mandatory vaccine. It was voluntary. It was only mandatory for those entering the militias to fight in the war. And during the 2 weeks that they were feeling ill, they just utilized that time to learn how to shoot and things like that. So it worked out well anyway. I wonder if that was the beginning of the idea of boot camp. But anyway, they didn't shut down businesses unless the business owner decided to. And that was a 10% mortality rate. Now, if they didn't freak out over a 10% mortality rate, what's our problem? Well, it's because
we got less than a fraction of a percent.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with the virus. It has everything to do with control. And this gets us back to the conversation we were saying earlier about how President Trump, I think, is also allowing a lot of this because it's revealing to everybody. I've joked with my friends. I've been wanting to move to the Oregon coast where I've got that property for over 20 years, and my wife has never wanted to. You know, she's always got an excuse why she's not ready to move. She grew up in Southern California, so on and so forth. I tell people, I say, you know, it's funny. For 20 years, I've been trying to convince my wife to move to Oregon, and I could not convince her. But yet, in a matter of a couple of months, one person has convinced her it's a good idea. Governor Gavin Newsom. So
that is scary, but that's true. That's how so many folks are. They're just kind of moving away from the cities to more rural areas and away from these communist states.
This state is bleeding people. We are losing so many people, so many businesses right now, and so they're scrambling because, you know, being our Democrat-run state, you know, they need lots of money, and the money's walking across the border. One of the proposals last month was an exit tax. They want to tax you for leaving the state and be able to tax you for up to 10 years after you leave the state. Wow. With an exit tax. That's the kind of stuff they're trying to do here in California because they're bleeding people and they're bleeding businesses. Some of the stuff, I mean, even my municipal government, and understand I live in a relatively conservative area. I've been ticketed. Last year I got ticketed a $750 ticket and then later on a $1,500 ticket for having a brown lawn. Now, we're in a drought.
For having
and we're
a
limited
brown
to
lawn?
55 gallons of water a day. However, I'm being ticketed for having a brown lawn. I got a ticket for having brown leaves on my tree. I have been ticketed for having a commercial vehicle in my driveway. It was my son's Honda Accord, but he has heavily tinted windows, and so they decided it was a commercial vehicle. When I argued and told them it wasn't, they said, well, you need to pay the fine and then argue that in court, and if you win, we'll give you your money back.
What in the devil? And is this like a city ordinance where you are?
This is a city.
Good grief, man.
So be glad you don't live in California. As all of you listening who don't live in California, and I've heard people from other states call us Commifornia.
Yeah,
exactly. Be glad you're not here. I grew up here. This is home. I hate having to leave my state. I grew up with a surfboard under my arm. You know, I love to go surfing. I love the fact that I can go to the mountain snow in the winter. You know, an hour drive up the mountain and I'm there. You know, an hour drive west, I'm at the beach. You know. An hour in any direction, and I've got, you know, SeaWorld and the Wild Animal Park and the San Diego Zoo and the L.A. Zoo and Disneyland and Knott's Berry Farm and Six Flags. But I love all that, but I can't afford to live here anymore. They are literally forcing me out of my own state. I mean, I love the no humidity. We have no – everything east of the Rockies has humidity. My family's all from Arkansas, and every time we visited Arkansas, you know, I hated it because of the humidity and the bugs.
Oh, it's dreadful. I walked out like 8:30 this morning, and it's like 90 degrees.
Oh, yeah. I remember I'd visit my Uncle Leroy's house in Hot Springs, Arkansas. Hot Springs. And he'd have his door open but his screen door closed, but you couldn't see through the screen door because there were so many mosquitoes on it wanting to come in.
Mm-hmm.
And then your shirt's just like, ugh, you know, you, because of the humidity. So, I mean, it's awesome here. We got the best weather. We got the beaches. We got the mountains. We got the deserts. I mean, you know, go sand railing, you know, out in the deserts, whatever, you know. Got everything. But they're running it. Taxes, ridiculous laws. I mean, I mentioned this off the air. If you are an independent contractor as of AB 5 last January, you cannot work for only one company more than a certain number of times. Otherwise, they've got to hire you as an employee. The thinking by the Democrats is that way you can get your health insurance.
That's insane.
But what it's doing is it's killing independent business and independent contractors. I actually had a television gig I was going to do, a weekly television show on a small local station. But because there's 52 weeks in a year and I was going to be on once per week, the rule was when it came to that independent contract was if I did more than 35 shows, they would have to hire me at that rate, television station. Mm-hmm. Well, they wanted to pay me a stipend because they couldn't afford to hire me. So what it did is it killed my television opportunity.
Yeah, you know, man, I think I mentioned this as well. That's essentially what happened to me. I won't get into where I'm working or was working, but it was the same thing with the fraud of Obamacare. Once that got rolled in, all my subcontracting jobs, if you will, got cut down because if I was working the old amount, I would be, you know, eligible for insurance. But now they just cut all my money, so not only do I not have insurance, I can't afford insurance. It's a sham.
Obamacare did the same thing to me. I was in construction at the time, and the construction company, being a small construction company, what they offered was cheap for them but expensive for us. I couldn't afford their insurance, so I was actually buying my health insurance independently.
That's what I was
after
doing.
After Obamacare, the cost of my independent health insurance tripled.
That's precisely and what happened to me. It was
going
to be over
$1,500
bucks.
My wife and I still don't have insurance to this day. I have now VA benefits because I'm a disabled veteran, and they've in the last few years have increased my percentage, which has allowed me to get some benefits from the VA. But my wife, yeah, she still has nothing because of Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of ties into something I was telling you before the show started, how if you really break down every leftist policy, it does the exact opposite of what they say. They claim they're for the little guy, they're for the poor, and they hate the wealthy, and they want to tax the wealthy, and they hate the big corporations, but yet all of their policies hurt the little guy and help the corporations and the wealthy. And I have a friend of mine, Benito Bernal, who ran for Congress in Los Angeles County in one of the districts. And he was running as a Republican. He had the previous election supported and was the top staff member of the guy who was opposing in the election. He used to be a Democrat. I said, well, what changed you from being a Democrat to Republican? He says, well, because I became high in the echelon of the Democrat Party, I was privy to meetings that most people aren't. And during a meeting, we're talking about different things, and I asked a question. Well, when it came to certain issues like poverty, why don't we try this, this, and this to resolve the problem? Let's get the solutions. He said this room went quiet. And one of the persons said, well, if we were to solve it, if we had solutions, what would we run on?
That's it.
They need the perpetual problem. They create poverty so they can run on trying to get rid of poverty. But they never will, because if they solve poverty, they'll have nothing to run on.
Yeah, I mean, I liken it to the carrot in front of the jackass. They just keep the carrot out there, and the American public just keeps walking, going, yeah, soon we're going to solve the drug problem and the poverty problem and the war problem and the infrastructure problem and on and on and on.
Well, it's like people ask me, I say, well, Doug, what do you think of the war on drugs? And my response is, well, the drugs haven't given in yet. They haven't what's the word? Oh, anyway, but
the CIA planes haven't stopped bringing it in.
There is that too. That's all.
Like Michael Rupert covered that like 20 years
ago.
Yeah,
that's another conversation.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, that gets us back to our president, and that's why he's so valuable, because he's outside that system. Because see, the reality is, when it comes to the machine of government and the machine of politics, there's not a lot of difference between the two parties. Mm-hmm. Now, when it comes to certain issues, we have Republicans are well-meaning. They're doing the best, and they are, and that part of the Republican Party is closest to what I believe, so that's why I'm a registered Republican. But when it comes down to that deep down, deep state machine, the line between Democrat and Republican disappears. And that's why, getting back to Donald Trump and my never-Trumper friend, he says, well, the guy's not even Republican. I said, well, don't you know that's the point? He's outside that machine. And he's not only outside the machine, he has vowed to dismantle that machine. Now, if you've got someone who's rough and tough, he's sort of like John Wayne toilet paper. You ever heard of John Wayne toilet paper? It's rough, right, tough, and yeah. Don't take no crap off anybody.
Indeed.
Okay? That's Trump. But he's also outside the system, so they can't control him. So what do you think that's doing to the people in the machine? Mm. They're in a panic. Of course they hate him. Of course they're willing to cause rioting across the United States. Of course they're willing to do a lot of things that they've done that's just absolutely out of our mind, ridiculous, impeachment and so on and so forth, because they are desperately crazy. They're desperate because this guy's trying to dismantle their bread and butter wagon that's been in play for well over 100 years.
Yeah, I mean, going back to that optics thing, a buddy of mine and I were talking before we got on the air, and he was saying the same thing I've said. You know, around the world, people used to think we were a joke. I mean, we had chicken hawks like Barry Sotaro and Bush Jr. and the Clinton crime family all in there. So, of course, all around the world, people are going, wow, this is great. We can pass NAFTA and GATT. And then we finally get Trump in there, and they're going, oh, man. Looks like we got a guy that's got to pay. The world this is going to be scary for us.
He's forcing the world to be honest with us. And the thing is, what he's doing is we're moving back towards this thing, Constitution. We're getting closer to this thing. And I tell people, if we were to get back to the Constitution, this would all go away. Because, see, our biggest problem is democracy. And now, many of your listeners probably just dropped their jaws. Well, wait a second. I love my democracy. It drives me – Fox News, you know, it's democracy, 2020. It drives me nuts. Democracy is the problem.
Oh, we got to protect our democracy.
Democracy is our problem. Now, let me give you a quick example. The audience, you're going to learn something now. Now you're not going to hear some political rhetoric. You're really going to learn something here. Okay, you've heard of the 17th Amendment, right?
Okay. Sure.
The U.S. Senate, for those of you who are not familiar with the 17th Amendment, the senators used to be appointed by the state legislatures. The reason why is if we have a bicameral Congress with two different houses, they check each other. And it gave also, since the delegates of the states were the ones that wrote the Constitution and created the federal government, it gave the states the ability to be present on that stage to basically keep their Frankenstein monster under control.
Yeah.
All right. Now, it's two senators per state. And what that does is it also gives the rural states as big of a voice in the Senate as the populated states. Once again, another check and balance. Population may be in charge of the House, but the rural states really have the voice when it comes to the Senate. That way, once again, we have a check here. We have opposites, different, giving the rural states a chance to voice and protect themselves against the dangerous populated states' House. At the state level, it used to be similar. You have your counties, and you had one state senator per county. And they were appointed by the county leadership. Imagine how different any of your states, especially California, but any of your states would be different if it was one state senator per county. The rural counties would outnumber the populated counties in your state senate, and it would be, well, just probably either different or more than what it is now when it comes to a particular ideology. In California, for example, remember, it used to be one senator per county. We have rural counties now where in Senate District 2, I believe it's 8 counties combined that make up Senate District 2 for one state senator. However, Los Angeles County has 13 state Senate districts. So 8 counties now gets one senator, and one county gets 13 state senators. Now, if we went back to that one county, one senator per county dynamic, gosh, the state senate in California would not only be very different, it would be dominated by Republicans. Now, if we were to get rid of the 17th Amendment and the state legislature is appointing the U.S. senators, and we have the assembly is blue and the state senate is red in California, well, what's going to happen with the U.S. senators? Well, they're going to have to make a compromise. So California would have one Democrat and one Republican senator in the U.S. House. I'm sorry, in the U.S. Senate. See how different our system would be if we got rid of these democratic mechanisms and went back to what makes us a republic. Now, I'm not saying democracy is completely supposed to be shunned. Democracy is not supposed to control. It's like with anything, when it comes to Constitution, it was a proper distribution of power. You don't want the president to have too much power. You don't want the Congress to have too much power. You don't want the judges to have too much power. You don't want the federal government to have too much power. You don't want the states to have too much power. Well, you don't want the voters to have too much power either. They have all the power, and it's a pure democracy, just like any such situation with when there's too much power in one place. It's a very bad thing. So what you do is you give the democratic voice to certain parts of government. In the beginning, that was the House. The House of Representatives was the only democratically elected office in the federal government. So, well, gosh, Doug, well, what about the voice of the people? Don't worry, the voice of the people had the most powerful weapon because the House has the power of the purse strings. That's you true. Don't like what's going on, the people can defund it, it stops. So the people still had a lot of power, but democracy didn't run everything. The population centers, in other words, didn't run everything. If you have democracy, the population centers run everything. And tyranny always rises out of population centers. Mm-hmm. And so our biggest problem is democracy. And I see these headlines from like the Washington Post. So Trump is ruining our democracy. And that's why I hope so.
Exactly.
I remember when the Ferguson riots were going on there in Missouri. And this rioter and there's flames in the background and things are burned down. And he runs up the camera and this is what democracy looks like. And I'm like, yeah, yep, that's exactly right. What democracy looks like. It's mob rule. Mm-hmm. Jefferson said that democracy is where 51% could vote away the rights of the other 49%. The tyranny of the majority. Adam said there was never a democracy that didn't commit suicide. And James Madison said that democracies are short in their lives and violent in their deaths. We are experiencing what we are experiencing right now because of democracy. And democracy stands against what this is about. The word democracy does not appear once in the Constitution nor the Declaration of Independence because we're not supposed to be a democracy. And that is our problem. If we were to get back to this and get rid of all this democratic stuff, all this goes away. Did you learn something, audience? Did you learn something?
I hope so. Indeed. I mean, that's one of those things that I think most people forget about, but I don't think a lot of people have that frame of reference just for any history. Right. It's so sad. Before my daughter was even born, I got this book. I was looking through all these old places online to try to find, I guess, what most people would perceive as antiquated books. I was trying to get older history books, you know. So I got one from the late 1800s, and I got one from, I think, 1943 that we've been reading now. And we got to the parts on the Civil War recently. And, you know, I was reading this to her, and I just paused because it really struck me the gravity of the Civil War and the deaths. And I'm looking at everything going on right now in the media, and, you know, it really just struck me. And I was going, man, I really just – and I was cleaning it up because my daughter's young, and I want to get into the death and all that stuff. But I was thinking, man, I hope – we're not going down that same path, but it looks kind of like it.
Well, and the frustrating thing is the American male has been demasculated.
Oh, yeah.
The American person, as a patriot, doesn't understand what it takes to defend liberty. I will give you the perspective with a real quick story. In 2016, I had a Trump Pence sticker in the back window of my car. Mm-hmm. I was driving a Camry at the time. I'm driving a pre-runner now. I love my truck. But anyway, so I'm driving my Camry, and I've got this sticker in the back window, and I do this speaking event, and this woman who walked with me out to my car with me, helping me carry, you know, my unsold books and stuff. And we were putting them in my trunk. And then she looks at the sticker. She says, "Wow, you're brave." And so, "What do you mean?" She says, "Well, you got that Trump sticker in your window. I wouldn't do that. My car would get keyed." I said, "Ma'am, think about what you just said. The founding fathers were willing to put on the line their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And you're worried about a paint job. Are we willing to fight and risk more than a paint job? Because if we're not willing to risk more than a paint job, we will lose our liberty. We have to be willing to fight, you know, Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death." Liberty was worth dying for. Fort McHenry, outnumbered. The Americans were outnumbered, outgunned. They're running low on ammo. But by dawn's early light, the flag was still there. They were willing to die for liberty. And yet we're worried about a paint job. I don't know if Americans have the intestinal fortitude to defend liberty. I hope I'm wrong. I hope that Americans out there are willing to fight the good fight. You got what's that kid's name? Kyle Rittenbach or whatever?
Kyle Rittenhouse. Yeah, I was going to mention him because I was talking about, I mean, I hate to keep talking family members. I was talking to a family member the other day. And they were like, "Well, you know, he probably shouldn't have been out there armed." And I was like, "No, the disgusting thing was it was a 17-year-old kid out there armed, and the police were standing by doing jack, and the other males that were of age were doing jack." That's the really disturbing,
ridiculous part of this whole thing. Down what he was trying to do, he probably strategically didn't do it the smartest way, but what he was trying to do, based on what his lawyer said and all that and what was happening, we need more Kyles.
Mm-hmm.
There's not enough Kyles out there. And amazing how the media treated it. The left burns down cities, burns businesses, and they're peaceful protesters. There's one kid out of defense shoots people, and he's, you know, this terrorist, and he's, you know, why? Because politically he stood on the other side of the fence. Now, I'm not necessarily saying everybody, you know, grab your rifles, get out there, start shooting people. I'm not necessarily saying that at this moment. But a push came to shove, and that was what it took. Do you have the, I said intestinal fortitude. Let me change this. Do you have the testicular fortitude?
Yeah, exactly.
To do it? I don't know. I'm not even sure if I do. I think I do.
Yeah.
But I'm not in that situation yet, so I don't know for sure if I do. Or are we going to be like the Australians and the British when they took their guns and just obediently hand them in?
I mean, I think there's some demographic that's going to resist the control of the communists, but I don't know what the numbers are. I mean, when you look at that optics word again, what I see is just a bunch of sheep and cowards going, "Man, I better not put on this hat. I better cover up my sticker. I better not even go out. I don't want to get chastised by the virtuous ones."
Yeah, well, you know, it's like I tell people, was Red Dawn just a work of fiction, or is it something that really could come true if we had the intestinal fortitude to do so? Do we have, you know, we've got people who, you got to understand something about this. When we won the American Revolution, we actually didn't win it. The British threw up their hands and went, "We'll come back later. These petulant colonists are just too much trouble. It's costing us too much money. It's costing us too many troops." Mm-hmm. We really didn't win the war. We wore them down and they left. But when they did, the British Empire did not recognize the United States as a sovereign country. So when this was written, it was an act of treason in the eyes of the British. Every man that put his signature on this was a traitor to the British Empire. When the War of 1812 happened, which I believe is our real American Revolution, and the White House was being burned down, and Madison was escaping with his life, and I had a nephew say, "Well, gosh, you know, Madison's kind of a coward." So no, as President of the United States, he would have been hung for treason by the British, because as far as they were concerned, there was no such thing as an American government. These people were willing to commit what was considered to be an act of treason. Only a third of the population agreed with them in the beginning, and only 3% of the population actually did the fighting. And we're nervous if we put a bumper sticker on our window.
Yeah.
We're worried about our paint job with a sticker. Really? And once again, I'm not necessarily saying run out there and start shooting, but on the same token, if it comes to something like that, we need to really search deep inside and ask ourselves, is liberty worth it? Is Patrick Henry's words the same words we want to use? Give me liberty or give me death. Are you familiar with the Tytler cycle?
I don't think I am.
All right. Alexander Tytler was a Scottish political philosopher. He died right around 1813. Hmm. And he loved the American system. And at one point in his life, he had theorized that the average system of liberty lasts between 200 and 250 years. We're right around the 240-year mark, by the way, just to give you a little perspective there.
Game clock's running down.
And there's a cycle. It's a big circle, and it begins with bondage. And from bondage goes to spiritual awakening, which makes sense. I mean, if you're in bondage, you know, it's like the old saying, there's no atheist in a foxhole. You're in bondage. God, help me. Spiritual awakening is real easy when you're in bondage. So from bondage, spiritual awakening. From spiritual awakening, courage. In our case, Revolutionary War. So bondage, spiritual awakening, courage. From courage comes liberty, and from liberty comes prosperity. Well, now you're at the bottom of the cycle. From there, it goes to selfishness, apathy, complacency, dependence upon the government, and back to bondage. That's the cycle of a system. Where are we on that cycle right now? And as I said it, I guarantee you most people watching are going, okay, yeah, I totally see us on that cycle.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we now? Apathy? Complacency? Dependence? Are we on the verge of bondage?
That's kind of where I think we are. I think we're those spoiled kids that have gotten everything for generation after generation. They're fat, dumb, and happy, and they're just going, I want my new car. I don't want to have to work for anything.
But if there's no free market system, all those things go bye-bye.
The mask sounds reasonable.
No free market system, all those things go bye-bye.
Yeah.
Now, here's the question. Wherever we are in that cycle, is it possible for us to cut across and not go into bondage first before we start it all over again? Is it possible for us to cut across to spiritual awakening? And notice that's what it takes. If we're not a godly people, we're not capable of this. If we don't get our collective godliness together, we're done. Benjamin Franklin said that only a virtuous people were capable of freedom. That as governments become debauched and violent, they have more need of masters. Off the top of my head, John Adams, that was Ben Franklin. John Adams said that our Constitution was made only for moral and religious people. It was wholly inadequate for the government of any other. George Washington said that the pillars of morality and religion were the most necessary pillars in our system. If we don't do those two things, it all falls. Samuel Adams repeated similar things, that if we don't practice the moralities of heaven, we are not deserving of the freedoms the Constitution gives us. We're not capable of it. We've got protesters in Portland burning Bibles. We've got the DNC 4 years ago voting God off for their platform. They're voting them back on amidst booze. Or was that 8 years ago? One or the other. We've got in this DNC, at the opening Pledge of Allegiance, they left out the words under God.
I heard that.
If we do that kind of stuff, we're not capable of this. This goes out the window. And for those of you who are not necessarily people of faith, this should still alarm you. Because the thing is, Judeo-Christian principles are good principles, and that's what our system is based on. The alternative is evil.
And I hate to say it, I think that's kind of where we are. I keep coming back to that biblical term discernment in mm-hmm. so many of these shows, because I feel like most of the populace now doesn't seem to have that discernment. They don't even seem to realize this is wrong.
Right.
And without that, I mean, I don't know where their anchor is, or if they're just completely lost and without hope. I don't know. It's kind of where I'm falling on.
Well, you know, Alexis de Tocqueville visited the United States in the 1830s. He actually came here to check out our penal system, because while Europeans told him that America was a joke, America was ready to collapse because, you know, it's impossible to run a system on the consent of the governed without a ruling class and so on and so forth, there had been good word about our penal system, the way we were handling our prison system. So he came out here to study it. And as he came out here to study that, he visited just about every state, and he got to realizing that there was more to America than just the penal system. And America wasn't failing. America was prospering. And America was free. And he saw something very curious that you did not see in Europe. The preachers, or the pastors, preached about politics, and the politicians prayed, but one group was not controlling the other. And he visited the government houses. He talked to the politicians. He talked to the pastors, and he visited the houses of worship. He came to the conclusion. Now, this is a misattributed quote. He didn't actually say this, but he essentially says this in his writings.
Sure.
That America is great because America is good, and that the strength of America is in her churches. When America stops being good, that is when America will fail.
Oh, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I know that quote, yeah. When America ceases to be good, she will cease to be great.
Mm-hmm. And while he didn't say those exact words in his writings, he essentially said that. Someone else came up with a quote and then attributed it to him, but he actually didn't say it in those words. But he did say it, like I said, throughout the book. Democracy in America is the name of the book. I read another book. This is maybe a book you might want to look into getting, if not the physical copy, at least digitally. A New View of the Constitution of the United States by John Taylor. 1823. This guy was not at the convention, but he was friends with everybody who were. And he says, what a miracle this country was. Because what most people don't know is that all of the delegates that went into that constitutional convention were big government, nationalist-minded people. But when they tried to apply their big government nationalist ideas into a system that was something other than what the British had, in other words, a more limited government, none of their ideas would work. So through the convention, they actually evolved and became more like Jefferson by the end of the convention. And they wrote this magnificent miracle that they had never planned on, and politically was not what they were at the beginning of the convention. In fact, and this gets us back to what we're talking about. In fact, the arguing also was so bad the first 4 to 5 weeks that they got nothing done except for the framework of the convention, and that was it, the rules. That was it. Benjamin Franklin, the elder statesman in the room, 81-year-old, adjusted his round spectacles, watched all these youngsters. If you were to take out the 4 or 5 oldest guys in the room, the average age in that convention was 27.
Wow.
So aside from the few of the oldsters, it was a pretty young crowd. And Benjamin Franklin's watching these guys going at it. I always imagine a video I've seen of the Taiwanese legislatures, you know, where they're jumping over the benches to beat each other up. I mean, it was almost that bad. Benjamin Franklin, you know, I don't know if you remember for those of you older, remember the E.F. Hutton commercials?
Oh,
when
E.F.
Hutton speaks, people listen. When Benjamin Franklin spoke, people listened. So he's on his table, and he's like, the room stops, and they all look at Benjamin Franklin, and he says, we're missing something. Something is missing. They're like, well, what's missing? We have all the quills. We have all the parchment. What's missing? And Franklin says, and I'm paraphrasing, during the war, we were on our knees. Yet during this vital period in history, have we forgotten the Father of Lights? If he knows every sparrow that falls to the ground, then surely he is involved in the creation of empires. And it was at that point he suggested they pray before each session. Now think about this, audience. What did I just say? Benjamin Franklin, the celebrated deist, was the guy who recommended prayer to the Christian God. Now they walked down to the nearest church, which was a Calvinist church, but they didn't use that pastor. They used someone they trusted, a Baptist minister who had given up his church so that he could fight in the Revolutionary War and serve as chaplain during the Revolutionary War. And I can't remember his name off the top of my head. He's in my latest book. I've got a whole thing on him and the prayer that was said. But he led them in prayer. Now understand, this is a group of people who are of different denominations. You think the denominations go at it now? They did not get along at all back then. Yeah. So you got all these men of different denominations in the same room on their knees praying to the same God. Praying that God blesses this convention that was not going well at all. Almost immediately, they got to work. What followed was a miracle.
I think that flies in the face of what most of the communists try to promulgate, that it's these old white guys, I tell you. They're all these old white guys.
They did it for their own power. They did it for, you know, money in their pocket. And you know the preamble tells you different?
Yeah.
All right, everybody. I'm going to force you to open your pocket constitution. Open it up to the preamble. For those of you who've got one. For those of you who don't have one, get one. If you don't have one, I'll mail you one. ConstitutionSpeaker@Yahoo.com or DouglasVGibbs@Reagan.com. ConstitutionSpeaker@Yahoo.com or DouglasVGibbs@Reagan.com. I'll mail you one if you want. I order like 400 of these a month. I hand them out. I mail them out. I give them to schools. I give them to Republican clubs on college campuses. All right. So in your preamble. And I'm assuming you guys can, you know, recite it, right? We the people of the United States in order form.
I think we can do it.
we could, you know, I was speaking to a Republican group of about 200 people with candidates in Los Angeles County about 2 years ago at a candidate meet and greet. And I was given only a few minutes to speak. And I told the crowd, hey, let's recite the preamble together. And I began. And by the time I got to the end, I only had one person out of those 200 still with me. The little old lady in the front, the oldest person there. Well, she probably memorized it when she was in school.
I had to do that in ninth grade. I'm sure it's now deemed racist and insensitive.
My nephew in the sixth grade had a chapter on the Constitution in his history book, was all excited because he loves his Uncle Doug and what his Uncle Doug does. And they skipped it over. They went to the teacher and asked, the teacher said this. Brandon, you have to understand, we only have so much time, so we have to skip over what's not important. All right. Southern California schools, gotta love it. All right. So anyway, back to our preamble. In our preamble, so we the people of the United States order form more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves, our posterity, to ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Now, remember that part? It says secure the blessings of liberty. What are the blessings of liberty? That's your natural rights to ourselves and our posterity. I'm just going to show you how the Founding Fathers right there tells you they didn't do it for them. They did it for you. Mm-hmm. Look at the word ourselves and look at the word posterity. Physically, there's a difference between those two words. What you'll notice is that ourselves is lowercase. Posterity has a capital P, it's uppercase. They didn't have italics. They were handwriting this document. Italics probably wouldn't work very well anyway. So to emphasize words, they capitalized them. So what's going on here is the word ourselves, not so much emphasis. The word posterity, that's the emphasis. So now, here's what they were saying. Secure the blessings of liberty, yeah, to ourselves, but especially to you, capital P posterity, those not yet born. We're signing this document for you. Sound like a bunch of white guys that did it for their own power and their own pockets? First of all, they weren't a bunch of old white guys. Like I said, you remove the oldsters from the group, and the average age was 27.
First, one thing I wanted to get into before we had to go was the importance of the church and all this. Folks often types like to marginalize the black robe regiment and the importance of that early Christian church just for the revolution and just for those founding fathers to even have a message or have a platform to do it.
The two most powerful voices for independence that really encouraged everybody to fight that war and to fight for independence was Thomas Paine's Common Sense pamphlet and the Black Robe Regiment. The Black Robe Regiment were the pastors who were willing to fight for independence, and they were preaching independence. And when the British soldiers first came here, that was their first target. They went after the Black Robe Regiment. The pastors, and remember Alexis de Tocqueville noticed this 60 years later in America. The pastors were preaching politics, and the politicians were praying, because there is no separation of church and state. And no, it's not true. You should talk about religion and politics because they're intertwined.
Exactly. To me, that's the only thing we're talking about. It connects to everything else. I don't care about the Netflix or the game or what you're doing next weekend at the barbecue. I mean, these things are intrinsic to every other aspect of our lives.
My mom raised me, yet never really was interested in history or understood what I was learning. She would take me to the library so I could learn this stuff. I actually started getting interested in the Constitution when I was 8 years old, and she would drive me to the library so I could look stuff up and read books at the library.
Yeah.
She wouldn't let me check them out because we didn't have the money for the – I grew up very impoverished. It was very tight growing up. I got one pair of shoes every 2 years, and if they started flapping, Dad used string to tie my shoe together so it wouldn't flap anymore. I mean, that's, you know, the kind of thing, right? That's the way I grew up. I grew up in North Long Beach, near South Compton. For those of you in Southern California, you know the area. And my mom never really understood what I was learning. Once I started teaching the Constitution classes that I do locally, I teach Constitution classes for free to adults. I have a donation bucket, but I teach it and go through the whole Constitution. And I started doing that in 2008. And she started coming to my classes all the way out in Temecula. She lived in Corona at the time, so I actually started a class in Corona so my mom wouldn't have to drive so far. And that class, you know, actually started a boom and has lots of people. And my mom, now that she understands the Constitution, she's like another me now. She knows it like I do. She went through the Constitution with me 3 or 4 times. She got to the point of the last few classes where she'd start saying what I was getting ready to say. I'm like, Mom, hang on. Let me teach you. You want the eraser and the pen here? You can. But, and she says to me, about a year ago, she says, you know, Doug, I'm so glad I know the Constitution like I do now, and I know history like I do now, because it has made my Bible studies come alive. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean? So when I'm in my Bible studies, I also see the founding fathers throughout those scriptures. And I learn a scripture, and I think, gosh, that must have been what they were thinking when they put this in the Constitution. This must have been the inspiration when they put this in the Declaration of Independence. She says, my Bible studies come alive because what I've realized knowing the founders is that they knew the Bible. And everything they wrote, the Bible, God is there. The word God is nowhere in the U.S. Constitution, yet God is throughout the document. The word God is not in the book of Esther either, but that doesn't mean that God's not in that book, that Old Testament book. And you'll hear leftists say, well, God's not the Constitution. The word God's, well, the word God isn't. But God, it's like we just said, blessings of liberty. Who gives the blessings? What are the blessings? Those are our natural rights that come from God. God is throughout the Constitution. And when we understand this and we understand our Bible, both of them start really making sense. And the thing is, and I'm going to go back to what I said before, we're not capable of this if we're not a godly people. This is only ink and paper if we're not a godly people and we're not willing to defend it.
That's absolute fact. And that's what's so scary, that if you look at all these various religions out there, you look at Christianity, and that is at the forefront of what's targeted by these communist organizations, by the Satanists or occultists or what have you. That's the number one enemy. That's why it was removed from the schools in the 60s. That's why there's, oh, it's separation of church and state. You can't have your bake sale that has a ichthus on the fish or anything on the cookies. Oh, that's separation of church and state. But
well, and how about the baker, you know, and the baking the cake, you know, the gay cake or whatever. And let me give a real quick lesson on your rights, folks. Natural rights. Declaration of Independence, right? Life, liberty, and the, what is it?
Happiness.
Pursuit of happiness. Everybody always gets it right. Everybody knows. It says that. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Do you have a right to be happy? No. But you have a right to pursue it. Do you have a right to health care? No. But you have a right to pursue it. Do you have a right? Do you have the right to have your cake baked a certain way? No. But you do have the right to pursue it. So if they are not going to bake the cake you want, that's okay. Pursue it elsewhere. You have a right to pursue it. You don't have a right for government to guarantee it. The word guarantee is not associated with your rights. The word protect is not associated with your rights. The biggest danger to your rights is government. So why would you want them protecting your rights if they're the greatest danger? That's like the Roman soldier jumping in front of you, holding up a shield and saying, don't worry, I'll protect you against me. Well, that's ridiculous. Right? So they're not there to protect your rights. They're not there to guarantee your rights. And your rights are not supposed to be guaranteed, but you can pursue them if they're out of the way. They are there, what it says in the Declaration, and it says in the preamble, remember that word in front of blessings of liberty? Secure. Secure is different from protect. Secure means to keep it where it belongs, your possession. It's like putting a baby in the car seat. You didn't put the baby in the car seat to protect the child. You put the baby in the car seat to secure the child in case there's heavy breakage, there's an accident, so that the child remains where the child's supposed to be. Your rights are supposed to be secured by government, that they remain where they belong in your possession. They are your rights. Their other job is just to get out of the way. Secure them so they belong to you, and then get out of the way so that you can have your life and your liberty, and you can pursue all of those other rights.
Amen to that. Like old Ronald Reagan was saying, the nine most terrifying words, we're the government, we're here to help. That's going to be the biggest hindrance to any liberty of an American citizen.
Exactly. Here in California, the answer is always more government, more fines, more control, and then they wonder why everybody's trying to leave. The problem with everybody trying to leave California is it's not just conservatives that are leaving. And so these got to be nice. Well, I tell people that I try not to say Barack Obama because I don't use profanity in my speeches.
That's true.
And there's nothing more profane than that name right there. But I'm going to use this term. It's not profanity, so don't worry. But it is probably a little controversial for some people. Libtards. So all these libtards are leaving California because they're trying to get away from the garbage that's created by Democrats, but yet they vote for the same stuff they're voted for in California that caused the problem.
Yeah.
And so what happens is the California liberalism is bleeding out through those people. So Arizona suddenly is turning purple. Texas is suddenly turning purple. Because you're getting all these Californians trying to escape the California liberalism, but they're taking it with them and they're voting the same way.
They're like an invasive species of beetle or something.
Yeah, well, I tell people, I say, hey, President Trump, when you're done with that wall between us and Mexico, put one around California just to keep the Californians in. You know, let me out first, but then after that, put a wall up just so that California doesn't affect the rest of the nation. It really is. It's the stuff that gets passed here. I mean, I could go through some of these things and it would boggle your mind.
I'm still stuck on the fact that you're getting fines for your grass and your tree. I thought it was some bizarre HOA thing, but it's a city thing.
Yeah, that's code enforcement. For the grass, it's, well, the first ticket was $750. The second was $1,500. So you combine the two, I'm over $2,000. Then what they do is at the end of the year, if I refuse to pay the fine, which I have, they take it out of my state tax return.
Good grief.
So what I try to do is I try to set up my taxes so I don't get any return.
That's a pretty good call.
But, here's what's funny about that ticket. The year before that, I was warned for overwatering my grass because some of the water trickled across the sidewalk while I was watering.
No.
So I was overwatering. How do you keep the water from trickling across the sidewalk?
You got to build a levee system just around your property, I guess.
You know, it's like we have construction out here, and you have dirt pads with dirt roads surrounded by dirt, but you got to put these round, long hay bales around the lots so that none of the dirt from the lot winds up in the street, even though the street has not been put in yet. Mm-hmm. And if you run over those round hay bales, I was in construction, so I dealt with this all the time. You run over them, you flatten them, it's a $10,000 fine. It can be as much as $25,000 fine if they're overly damaged to the general contractor. And then they wonder why houses are so expensive out here.
I just wouldn't want to do construction out there. That's insane. That's way worse than just the regular old, inspections from the city, inspections for water and all that mess. Yeah. Good grief.
Oh, the rules are absolutely – some of the rules are absolutely amazing. Some of the OSHA rules are absolutely amazing. You are required in construction to wear a hard hat.
Yeah.
At any time, period. What I did was I trenched the foundations for houses. We're usually the first ones there. So it would be us, our machine, our tractor, and dirt. None of the other building is in there yet because there's nothing built yet. We're just digging ditches in the ground. But guess what? We got to wear those hard hats, because something might fall from the sky and hit us in the head. And we could be fined for it. Hmm. Not only that, but also, once again, we're out in the middle of nowhere. Dirt lots, dirt streets, but we better have those orange vests on also, to protect us against, getting hit by somebody who didn't see us.
Good grief.
So, liberty, and let's leave it with this. I know we're getting long here.
Sounds good.
Long has been good, though, right?
Indeed, okay. Man. We could talk all day. We could just talk about this.
But we both have things to do. I just have the law office I'm dealing with. My nonprofit, by the way, just for your edification, is going to sue Kamala Harris for her ineligibility.
Good.
But anyway, it's all about liberty. Everything comes down to liberty. If you want to wear a face mask, for example, that's your choice. You have the liberty. Even though I think it's foolish, you have the liberty to wear that face mask. But liberty goes both ways. If you have the liberty to wear it, I should have the liberty not to. If you have the liberty to have a cake baked the way you want, I should have the liberty not to make it if I don't want to. Find somebody who will. As a pastor, if I want the liberty of not marrying a certain group of people, that's fine. You have a liberty to get married, but go find someone who's willing to do it. Don't force, because when you start forcing, that's not liberty. Liberty just went out the window.
Yeah. Now we're into tyranny.
It's all about liberty, and liberty is choice. Now, that said, that does not mean it's a libertarian free-for-all. We do have a rule of law in place. We know what's right and wrong. There are certain laws in place. And it has nothing to do with liberty and everything to do with right and wrong. So we do have laws that say, don't kill other people. You may think you have the liberty, but you know what? What you think is a right is interfering with somebody else's right of life. Because while we have liberty and our rights stop when they interfere with the next person's right. I have the liberty and the right to go through that intersection, but my liberty to go through that intersection stops at your bumper. I have the liberty and the freedom and the right to swing my arms, but I got to be responsible with that right because you have a right not to be punched in the nose by my swinging arms. So laws are in place for that. So it's all about liberty. Do what you want. Be free. But there is a rule of law. There is a right and wrong. That's why laws are in place. That's our basic John Locke lesson.
Amen to that, man. I love it. I could not possibly agree with you more.
Most people, let me wrap it up with this.
Go for it.
The reason why people appreciate what I do, the Lord has given me this incredible gift of explaining things in ways where people go, huh, I had not thought of it that way. That makes sense. I have that uncanny ability. Thank you, Lord. So I may not have told you anything you didn't know, but I told it to you in such a way where you went, huh, okay, now I get it. Yellow light pops on, whatever. Now, if you're interested in what I do, DouglasVGibbs.com, PoliticalPistachio.com, DouglasVGibbs, that's two Bs, .com, or PoliticalPistachio, yes, like the nut, .com is my blog. If you want to be on my email list on the sidebar, PoliticalPistachio.com, it says join my email list. Click that, put in the information, you'll get my emails. In addition to reminders for classes, you'll get some of the articles I write. Some of the articles I write get national attention because I also write for a site called Canada Free Press. Canada Free Press shows up on Whatfinger often. If you know what Whatfinger is, it's a conservative version of Drudge. So also, I have a wonderful video collection, and guess what? It's online. Enemies Within. Agenda, Agenda 2. I even have a 60 Minutes interview episode where they're talking about how the Clintons were involved with China and basically gave away our technology to China.
Absolutely.
Right by where on that right sidebar of politicalpistachio.com where it says, you know, you can join my email list. Well, there's also watch my personal videos. Click that link. Comes up. They're all alphabetical order. There's also like other folders. One of them is the Clinton Chronicles, if you've heard of the Clinton Chronicles. I'm actually friends with the producer and filmer and editor of that particular series of movies. They're all online. Check it out. Of course, if you want to buy my books, hit my books link when you go to my website, blah, 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 blah. All right. I plugged myself, too, while I was on my way out.
I love it. I was going to do it for you. I'm glad you pulled it off.
Don't forget the radio show. Radio show, KMET, 1490 AM on Saturday. So I almost forgot about that. All right. Well, if you go to my website, there's like a radio link and there's a video link. All my videos I've ever done. Hit video. I've got them all there. And they're categorized about what they're about, birthright citizenship, whatever. You want to see me, you know, the video on certain subjects, constitutional subjects, go there. So on both of my sites, I've got the links for pretty much everything I do. But I tell you what.
Sounds good.
God gave me a gift of gab. And when I was growing up and people said, Doug, you need to figure out how to use that gift of gab for good. I think I'm there. But I do love spreading the good word. And thank you for having me. I really enjoy getting to know you and talking to you. You're a fantastic individual. I hope this grows. I will help plug it. Send me any information I need to help advertise and put out links and all that, and I'll do what I can to help you out. As for you, audience, and I don't know the size of the audience, but I tell you what, I expect all of you to fight for this, right? More than just a paint job, right? We got to.
Please, I'll tell you what. We cannot go quietly into the night.
Exactly. And you're right. You know, a lot of the signs that we're seeing now are similar to the ones we saw approaching the war between the states. It's a scary time. But you know what? Only took 3% of the American public to win the American Revolution. 3% actually fought it. It's not a big number. I think we can get more than 3% of us out there. But we got to be willing to do it. We got to be willing to risk more than a paint job.
That's beautiful. I love it. And I definitely could not agree more. Anybody who's out there and listening to this and at the office, in the car, I would say at the gym, but I think that's illegal now. Nevertheless, you can go to anomicage.com and I assure you I will have all of Doug's links. I'll have the video, the audio, where to find everything Douglas V. Gibbs That'll all be at AnomicAge.com. So please check out the site. And as I always close with, you cannot do everything, but you can absolutely do something. So whether that's something big or something small, that's up to you. But please get out there and make that difference. Let us not go quietly into the night. So next time, be safe out there, and I'll be seeing you sooner than later in the Anomic Age.
Thank you for listening to The Anomic Age, a John Age project. For past shows, further info, and to comment, go to AnomicAge.com. That's AnomicAge.com. Till next time, thank you for listening to The Anomic Age. I'm going to go to the next one.